This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and shall we start with the recriminations? Is it Trump's fault that the Associated Press, at least, has declared Raphael Warnock the victor over Kelly Loeffler in one Georgia Senate race, and John Ossoff, in a race that's still too close to call, leads David Perdue by about 16,000 votes in the other Senate race?
Or is it Lynn Wood's fault for saying, don't go vote, don't vote, the system's broken, stay home?
312.
Do you want to say it? You say it. You say it better in the key of G.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 646-36DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Here is what Raphael Warnock said in declaring victory. Now it's important, and you'll hear from her, to note that Kelly Loeffler has not conceded the race. Yep.
Georgia, I am honored by the faith that you have shown in me. And I promise you this tonight. I am going to the Senate to work for all of Georgia. No matter who you cast your vote for in this election, in this moment in American history. So I come before you tonight as a man who knows that the improbable journey that led me to this place in this historic moment in America could only happen here. We were told that we couldn't win this election. But tonight, we prove that with hope, hard work, and the people by our side, anything is possible. Georgia, I am honored.
It's so interesting to listen to Reverend Pro-Choice celebrating Georgia's end of worshiping whiteness.
Yes.
Apparently.
Yeah.
No more worshiping whiteness in Georgia.
We need to play that again, too.
It's remarkable. The you get the typical victory speech with all of the usual cliches. But they run afoul of the other cliches that Raphael Warnock has trafficked in his entire adult life, all the identitarian race-hustling cliches. In America, this could only happen in America, with hard work and hope, anything is possible in America. Raphael Warnock, like most identitarian political hacks, whether they wear the cloth or not, talks about how America is indelibly racist. It's systemically racist.
Yeah.
The deck is stacked against people like Raphael Warnock.
How could he possibly
win? This is why you have to have government intercede and say, we shall have so many of this color and so many of that color and so many of this gender and so many of that gender. And we shall redefine these terms and redefine these institutions. It's just remarkable. I mean, I know he doesn't mean what he's saying, Raphael Warnock, because he's a demagogue. But I just want to point it out, regardless, that could it be nice to see somebody challenged on their cant once in a while? I know that's not going to happen from the D.C. press corps. Loeffler came out in the early morning hours this morning and had this to say to her supporters.
We got lots of things to go out, but we got some work to do here. This is a game of inches. We're going to win this election. We're going to save this country. We're going to make sure every vote is counted. That's right. Every legal vote will be counted, and I'm not going to stop working. In the morning, in fact, I'm going to be heading to Washington, D.C. to keep fighting. That's right.
Keep fighting for this president. Obviously, she's referring to today and the electoral college challenges that will be forthcoming. So she has not conceded, but she's down 40,000 votes. Yeah, and again, John Ossoff up about 16,000 votes, and David Perdue. So it's not looking good. And the race has turned, particularly the Perdue Ossoff race, as here we go again, outstanding precincts Democrat-heavy Fulton and DeKalb counties came in late last night into the morning hours, and that's what flipped the script in favor of Ossoff at present.
I feel sick to my stomach. I couldn't sleep last night. Is this really happening? And I should, you know, be the big girl and grow up. But how did this happen? Warnock, he's a pro-abort pastor. He is an alleged wife beater. He ran over his wife's foot with his car. And she even said, when she said what she said, that he's not who you think he is, basically saying he's a despicable human being, and you're going to vote him to the U.S. Senate? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
So the yesterday was basically a rerun of November 3rd.
Yeah. Yep.
And it was always going to be that. It could have been John and Jane Doe running against Loeffler and Perdue. It was clear that Warnock and Ossoff were not the issue. Joe Biden who? Joe Biden was irrelevant. This isn't about a Biden agenda or Biden coming in late and saying, if Ossoff and Warnock win, you'll get $2,000. This was all about Trump.
Yeah.
And to some extent, the Republican establishment and the fight between Trump and the Republican establishment, perhaps best exemplified by Brad Raffensperger, somebody you never heard of until the last 6 weeks and probably wish you never did. I certainly wish I never did.
Me neither.
You shouldn't know who your Secretary of State
Mr.
is,
Squirrel.
Really. But that's what it was.
Yeah.
That's absolutely what it was. And so what Georgia voters did, as a lot of voters did, is say, you know, I think the presidential election should be treated like a grade school student council election. If I don't like somebody, some aspect of their personality, then I don't care how competent they are or what kind of job they've done vis-a-vis what my expectations are for their opponent. I'm going to send a message for some notion of propriety or civility or my preferred style of communication. And that's what a lot of voters did. And they did it twice in Georgia. Bill and Glen Ellen, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Wow.
Oh, hey, Peggy. Oh,
Bill and Glen Ellen, sorry.
I blame the establishment Republicans. When Trump came in, they didn't support him. They attacked him at every turn. And the Republican voters saw this. And it's like, if they're not going to support our president the way the Democrats support every one of their criminals, how can we support them? I mean, they allowed them to steal the presidential election. And then, knowing that they stole the presidential election, they let them take the Georgia election, too. You have that Raffensperger guy who, what Democrat Secretary of State would say to a Democrat president, no, you can't see the results of the thing, even though it may help you to take back the state. You know, they would have done everything to allow that Democrat to win. They, you know, it's just, when the establishment Republicans start to blame Trump, we need to tell them to shut up and sit down because they're the problem, not Trump. Without Trump, they wouldn't have won all of the House seats that they won. The only reason that they won those House seats is because Trump was there and he was on the ticket. We lost in 2018 the House because the Republicans backstabbed Trump and let the Democrats destroy him. And then in 2020, when Trump was on the ticket, We voted for the Republicans to help Trump. Remember, in 2018, the Republicans didn't lose the Senate because Trump put iron in their backs to protect Kavanaugh. And so people voted for the Republicans in the Senate, but they didn't vote for the establishment Republicans in the House. And there are the morons in the Republican Party who think, oh, now that Trump's gone, they're going to love us and they're going to vote us into office. I have no idea what they're thinking. Because 2016 was the last free and fair election, and the Republicans, I think, are done. I don't think they're going to win anything anymore because Republican voters can't stand them.
All right. Thanks for the call, Bill. That started already, what Bill was describing, the Politico article with, you know, unnamed senior Republican strategists and so on and so forth, suggesting that, well, what I said in this sense, that it was a referendum on Trump, which and what transpired on November 3rd, which I think it was. But, you know, arguing in the alternative, as the D.C. creatures are wont to do, on the one hand, blaming Trump for continuing to focus on the outcome of the November 3rd election in Georgia and you know, make his case. But all, at the same time, saying he needed to be more present in Georgia for the Senate candidates. So, want him to not make his case about November 3rd, but you want him to, you know, have more rallies for Loeffler and Perdue because he needed to turn out the base that you are conceding you can't turn out. It's sort of an interesting way to argue. Here's another example of this, which is just wildly tiresome for me. Josh Holmes is a former chief of staff for Mitch McConnell. And he tweeted out, "Suburbs, my friends, the suburbs. I feel like a one-trick pony, but here we are again. We went from talking about jobs and the economy to QAnon election conspiracies in 4 short years, and, as it turns out, they were listening." First of all, Josh Holmes is a one-trick pony.
Yeah.
Who was talking about QAnon conspiracy theories? Who? Who's the we?
I don't know.
We went from talking about jobs and the economy. Was there a speech or an interview that Trump gave over the last 2 years, 3 years, in which he did not mention, did not make the claim that he created the greatest economy in U.S. history and then tick off the historically low unemployment numbers? I mean, you could not have a conversation with Trump without him bringing up jobs and the economy. So that's just factually incorrect. And oh, by the way, the suburbs, as we've talked about at some length on this show, are not monolithic. But the mentality of D.C. consultants like former Mitch McConnell chief of staff Josh Holmes, that is monolithic, unfortunately. Mel in Mount Prospect.
Yeah, what was the turnout? I was listening to a guy in Fox. He was talking about the turnout. Is the turnout, Republican turnout, was it, they didn't turn out? That was his one comment he made. And then he said that he talked about the states that are going purple, and he threw Georgia into that. Then he threw in Florida, Arizona, Texas. He mentioned Texas. I mean,
Georgia's blue.
I'm sorry.
I said Georgia's blue, not purple. I mean.
Well.
Well, they used the term, he definitely used the term purple because it got my attention, no question about it. And he threw Florida, Arizona into that same, in Texas, he said.
Thanks for the call, Mel. Well, Florida, you see, he's you got right. Governor DeSantis, Republican. You got Senator Scott, that's a Republican. You got Senator Rubio, that's a Republican. And Senator Scott was a pickup defeating Democrat Bill Nelson. So I don't know about Florida going purple.
Florida's,
I think actually Florida's getting more red.
Yes.
Arizona, Georgia, yeah.
It's places that Illinoisans moved to. I mean, well, you think about it, like, they all moved to Arizona and to Georgia and to, from California, too. They did.
Florida, Texas. This whole migration thing, you have to really dig into the state's numbers because some states are getting more red because of migration. Red states are getting redder because, yes, there's Illinoisans moving to Georgia, Arizona, Florida, Texas, Tennessee, and elsewhere, and New Yorkers and Californians, too. Don't forget, those are big populous states, and even though conservatives are the minority in those states, they can represent a majority of those out-migrating, which is why those states, California, New York, Illinois, are getting bluer. So it's a little bit more complicated than just saying people moving from Illinois. Everywhere they move, it makes it bluer in the other blue states as well. That's not true, actually. It's not borne out by the numbers. But what's happening in Georgia, there could be something afoot there. What's happening in Arizona, there could be something afoot there in Scottsdale.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and we're talking about the Georgia Senate races with AP declaring Warnock the winner over Loeffler and the race too close to call between Perdue and Ossoff. At this juncture, Loeffler not conceding, though, as we noted.
And she's heading to Washington, D.C. today.
On Monday night, Republican congressman from Texas, Chip Roy, was on with Tucker Carlson. He had this to say if what looks likely to happen does indeed come to pass.
I mean, we're now basically at full-scale hot conflict in this country, whereas right now we're at a cold civil war. We've got a major problem in this country where the American people, the regular people out there that are working every day, hardworking Americans, that are getting trampled by a system that is rigged against them, as you said. That is what is at stake. And if the American people in Georgia don't show up, if Georgians don't show up and ensure that we hold the Senate in Republican hands, then that's what's happening.
That's what's happening, Chip Roy says. We're going from a cold civil war to a hot conflict. You agree? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Well, I knew we were in trouble when I watched Stacey Abrams, the linebacker. What did you call her? She's a defensive lineman.
Yeah, I'm blocking back.
Yeah, I'm fine. When she was on with on this week with ABC 7, and she said flat out, we've registered 65,000 people under the age of 29, mostly people of color, who did not vote in the general election. That's what we did. Not, oh,
well,
65,000 votes. All right.
Well, we don't have exit polling at this point, so you know, we don't know what the composition of the electorate will turn out to be exactly. There were a little over 4.9 million ballots cast in the November 3rd election for president in Georgia. There are about 4 million ballots cast in the two Senate races as we report.
3 million people voted early.
And so
they're right. That's their right. I mean,
and so one of the things that will be under discussion, I mean, it is, again, state and local matters, these things we call elections are. And in a lot of these states that we've spent the last 6 weeks, 8 weeks discussing, you have Republican legislatures. You have Republican-controlled legislatures. Certainly that's the case in Georgia, in Arizona, in Michigan, in Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. So there should be perhaps some pressure brought to bear at the local level on state legislators and legislatures to end the willy-nilly vote-by-mail protocol for elections, whether they be for president or U.S. Senate or local dog catcher. You know, there's a lot of layers to this. One other thing before we take more of your calls. I had an interesting conversation on my other program yesterday with Susan Crabtree, who's the Washington, D.C. Reporter for RealClearPolitics.com. And, you know, one of the things that she said, and I'm not sure this would have made a material difference, but it speaks to competence regardless, is, you know, that the Republican Senatorial Committee was caught a little bit flat-footed with Warnock and Ossoff. They didn't really get up and running with the full complement of the opposition research that they should have had and could have deployed earlier because they were focused on, you know, other races in the run-up to November 3rd. And she talked about, you know, there's a lot of donors that were none too happy with the Republican Senatorial Committee and how much money they had to kick in after November 3rd. Right. To try to salvage these two races in Georgia, because the RSCC, Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee, was caught flat-footed in Georgia and didn't expect to have two runoffs in Georgia and got two runoffs in Georgia.
Well, they were both grossly outspent. I mean, Ossoff was, what, $108 million?
Yeah, both over $100
million. $65
million? Yeah. But the point is, the argument is, if the senatorial committee was competent and what they said was going to come to pass came to pass, then you wouldn't have had runoffs at all.
Right.
And so, and the opposition research, which, I mean, there's reams of it on Warnock. We've talked about it in this show. Ossoff as well. It came late.
Right.
Now, would have doing a better job of profiling who Ossoff and Warnock are, would it have changed the outcome? Maybe. I mean, races this close, maybe. I think it's, you know, Trump overwhelms everything, but on the margins, could spend making sure everybody knew the statements Warnock has made over the years, making sure everybody knew the obstruction of justice charge against him with respect to a criminal investigation into a day camp that his church was running, the situation with his wife that you described earlier, would that have helped? Ossoff's ties
to
Ossoff's perspective on Beijing vis-a-vis his, you know, business dealings there or with Chinese interests. I mean, limited as they are, because the entirety of John Ossoff is limited. He basically has no resume. He's just a you know, progressive cipher. Would have doing a better job change the outcome? Well, these are going to be the questions. By the way, I mentioned on the show last week, and I was skeptical of it, looking at the Trafalgar polling and hearing from other parties. But the RNC expected David Perdue to win easily, and they said that Kelly Loeffler had a lead as of late last week. That's what I heard from a reliable source. So there's a competency question too. You know, how thick is the Republican establishment bubble inside the Beltway? Verlon on the South Side.
Amy, I thought you almost stole my thunder. I want to say this without getting angry. I told you all a month ago on your show that they're going to make it look good, like you're in the game, like you're close, but you're never in the game now. You have empty suits, or for lack of a better term, an empty vessel, like that Secretary of State from Georgia that wants to put a nice face on it and talk a good game, but yet he's not going to do anything about it. Yet, Amy, I saw Stacey Abrams, too. It was on Stephanopoulos' show. Mm-hmm. And guess what? The Secretary of State's not telling you. She got legislation. She said it out her own mouth. She got legislation passed called No Match, whereas though you got the governor down there asking for an audit. He can't. You know, they don't do signature matches, and they don't throw out ballots anymore. So guess what? Those phony ballots that they got sent in to make these people win, it's going to always happen. You can't beat the cheat. The fix is in. So guess what? I'm done with this politics crap, because they're going to start these Stacey Abrams types are going to pop up in all of the Republican states, and they're going to in all of the cities and where they got a lot of people, and they stolen the Electoral College from us. They've figured out a way to take it and make it look legit. So guess what? I'm going to worry about social issues like pedophile priests, like Father Flager raping little boys. That's what I'm going to worry about. You know what? Because Bill Paxton said it best. Game over, man. Game over.
All right, Furlan, thanks for the call.
Well, we could lick our wounds for a day. We could grieve. And that's what we're here for. I mean, did not see this coming. I honestly thought that at least one of the Senate seats would be Republican. And now what are we going to have? We're going to pack the courts. Puerto Rico is going to become a state. Washington, D.C. Then you're going to have four more senators. Like, three of the four are going to be Democrats. We'll never have a Republican president ever again.
Yeah, I think there's that is very much, all those things are very much in doubt.
Is it Joe Manchin? Susan Collins?
And I'm not, well, Susan Collins is a Republican. I'm not particularly comfortable resting the future of America in the hands of Joe Manchin or a couple of other self-styled moderate Democrats, let me be clear. Okay. But the idea that they won't read the tea leaves for their own political survival, many of whom are up in 2 years with respect to some of the more radical proposals that many Democrat socialists want to advance, I think is an open question at minimum. Tony in Downers Grove.
Well, Dan, so much to say, but I'll just say this. I listen to your show. I'll listen to a couple other conservative shows, and I'll hear stories, and then I'll go look them up. Sometimes they're hard to find because you can't get it on Google, and I'll search several sources for the same story, and I'll post it on Facebook. And typically, what you would hear is nothing. Nobody ever wants to talk policy, and like you said, they just want to talk about how bad the orange ban is. So that's a problem. The other problem, like you said, is Republicans need to take their dunce cap off, because competency in Republicans does not go hand in hand. And I'm loving these senators and congressmen that are talking about mail-in votes and stealing the Electoral College. Hey, well, guess what? You don't have control right now. You're not going to have control. So what do you think is going to happen now? They don't know how to be front and center. And I have no idea where this is going, but it's very, very, very concerning to me. But I appreciate it.
Thanks for the call, Tony. Interesting note, too, is that if there's a recount, particularly in the Ossoff-Perdue race, there's the law in Georgia provides if it's within 0.5 of a percentage point, the recount is triggered. Well, so now you're going to have the guy who's waiting for Senator Perdue to apologize to his wife.
Exactly. Be in charge,
be in charge of a recount.
Oh, my God. And remember what Chuck Schumer said.
Now we take Georgia, and then we change the world.
Yeah!
I'm sorry, can you repeat that, Mr. Schumer?
Take Georgia, and then we change the world.
Jim and Crown Point.
You know, I knew it was over when they had Cardi B, a woman who talked about her troubles with her bathroom hygiene due to her long nails, interview Joe Biden. What normal person would want her within a million miles of him? He'll probably have her as his press secretary.
Sure, why
not? No, he's got a stack of women helping him out there.
Thanks for the call. the Cardi B watershed moment for Jim. John in Bridgeport.
Hello. Listen, I don't know what the heck the Republicans could have done. There is no way the Democrats were going to allow the Republicans to win.
Nope.
We tripped over the same stone twice, guys. We tripped over the same stone twice. And until legislature gets changed, that's going to continue to happen. Giuliani and Bannon, they said the same thing. This is what's going to happen. They said it 3 weeks ago. This is exactly what's going to happen, and it did. Lou Dobbs on Fox yesterday was trying to raise a strong point, and they left the air and went to Strange Inheritance TV show. It was the strangest thing, but I'm not surprised that we tripped over the same stone again. And guys, I don't know what else to do. Do we still stand for the flag anymore? Do we still tell our kids about the Pledge of Allegiance? Because this group isn't going to want us to do that. So I'm not so sure anymore how to go forward on this.
Well, just make sure you refer to your children in gender-neutral language, John. That's a start. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. To curry favor
right.
with your
yes.
Newspeak overlords, Mike
yes.
and Plano.
The mother is bad.
Hey, guys. That Josh Holmes comment with the QAnon, that tells you all you need to know about what the establishment GOP feels about Trump supporters.
That's
they
right.
look down on us. They can't stand Trump supporters. Now, look, I know what QAnon is, but I don't talk about it. I certainly wouldn't make it part of a Republican campaign. But that just shows you what you need to know about these guys and their inability to connect with Trump voters. They're still, and I told you this yesterday, they're still playing the game of chasing the suburban soccer moms, many of whom don't vote Republican anymore, never will again, or never have in the first place, instead of trying to expand the base with the groups that Trump was reaching out to and did better with in 2020. So we need more pro-Trump voices in the party. And when I say pro-Trump, I'm not talking about 100% Trump worship. Like, Dan, I know you're not pro-Trump all the time, but I still consider you pro-Trump because you believe largely in what he believes and you want to fight. That's what we need.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Appreciate it. Paul in Worth.
Yes, I have a couple quick questions for you guys. Is Mark Zuckerberg the new Soros? Number two, if Trump writes a tell-all book about his presidency, how many copies will it sell? And if the Russians stole the 2016 election for Trump, how come they didn't steal this one? And last but not least, what do the Chinese have in store for us this year? See you guys.
Thanks for the call, Paul. A lot of questions here. Is Zuckerberg the new Soros? That's sort of interesting. No, Soros is the new Soros. He's still around. And
China can't
money.
Steal anything more from us. Taking everything.
But again, it's something that Republicans sort of lost after big show hearings over the last couple of years is the influence of big tech.
Yeah.
And so Zucker boxes for mail-in voting, yeah. But also Google search algorithms and Twitter and Facebook censors and so forth.
And they've been voting in Georgia for a month. Think about it. Polls have been open for a month, Dan. And the more time you have, the more vulnerable the system is. And you've said that. A great man once said that.
Marvin in Burlington, Wisconsin.
Hi, good morning. You know, I was listening to the congressman about the hot conflict. I think you might have some of that. That's not what I call it about, but between city people and people who live in the rural communities, because I don't think the rural communities are going to take too well to people overlording them on how and what to teach their kids in schools.
I
my question was going to be, Yeah, well, not where I'm at, but you know, you make the choice to send him to parochial school, and but the question I have is, how is the Chinese government ever going to be held accountable now for this virus, or the truth ever going to come out about how this virus was thrown upon the world? I mean, I have absolutely no faith in our country ever getting any compensation for this. And you know, for them to lie to the WHO for months and have this put all the disinformation that they've put out from their country, how can we count on our government now to stand up and exact any kind of compensation or even get the truth out about it all?
Thanks for the call, Marvin. I think it's a good question you raise, because if those results in Georgia hold up, what we know for at least the next 2 years is you have both the executive and the legislative branch controlled by people who are interested in beautiful lies, not uncomfortable truths, and they make policies based on those beautiful lies. So I think your question is a salient one. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We turn our attention away from politics at the national level for a moment to, to do a little bit of a Karnak routine here. Father Flager, Jacob Blake, Kim Fox.
Where do you want to start?
I'll connect the dots in a minute. But Father Flager, he gone. Father Flager has been exiled after it was revealed that there's an allegation that he sexually abused a minor that's some four decades old. Cardinal Supich releasing a letter that suggests that this should not be taken as evidence of innocence or guilt. It's an allegation, and so the arch is following these protocols, and Flager has to live away from St. Sabinus for the time.
And they're fighting back. I mean, they said, you know, that these allegations are going to prove that they're false and that he'll be, you know, back.
The St. Sabina Church.
St. Sabina Church.
The cabinet, yes.
Yes, they said that, you know, he'll take time away, but they think that these allegations are just allegations, that they're false allegations, and he's been wrongly accused and that he'll be back at the pulpit. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Could we have any more news yesterday? Literally, when you think it would stop, it kept coming. And I, are you surprised at all by Father Flager, Dan, about these allegations?
Oh, well, I have no, you know, basis to comment on the accuracy of the allegations, the truth of the allegations. I just have this to say about Father Flager. He is a disgrace to the Catholic Church. He has been for the better part of 45 years. He is unfortunately typical of the sort of demagoguery that has beset Chicago's political culture and made the city much, much worse over the time he has been here, much the same way that Jesse Jackson Sr. has, much the same way that Louis Farrakhan has, much the same way that Jeremiah Wright did. Race hustling demagogues. They do not count among their accomplishments improving public safety in the communities they profess to serve, improving the quality of education in the communities they profess to serve, improving economic opportunities in the communities they profess to serve. They're abject failures is what they are. The only thing they've succeeded is building nice little public profiles for themselves and a nice little lifestyle, in the case of Jesse Jackson Sr. and Louis Farrakhan, because of a attendant docile white media in Chicago. Father Flager just had a, you know, one of his pro forma anti-violence marches last week.
Right.
How do we know that? Why do we know that? Because the cameras that are left in these network affiliates dutifully rush out to cover what? What is new? The same pronouncement from Father Flager.
He's been there.
That's
since
been made for 40 years.
I know. Yeah.
What is new?
There's some
track record of success. We need to listen to what this guy's saying because, boy, he's really making things happen. Clearly not. And who does he prop up and people like him? These dum-dums like Kim Fox, who tweeted this out yesterday since an anti-violence march last Thursday led by Father Flager. A new study from Loyola Chicago shows that 40% of those arrested on gun charges have no prior arrest for violent crime, and 80% have no prior convictions for violent crime. Reforms around issues like bail are simply not driving increases in violence. Another way to look at that, as CWB Chicago pointed out, is that a new study from Loyola Chicago shows that 60% of those arrested on gun charges do have prior violent arrests for violent crime. If 40% don't, that means 60%
do, dummy.
And 80% have no prior convictions for a violent crime, though that means 20% do have a prior conviction for a violent crime. So, you know, 20% of a sizable number, and it doesn't need to be that sizable to have a sizable impact, a negative one on public safety. 20% of people with prior convictions, 60% of people arrested on gun charges with previous arrests for violent crime, and you want to, you know, essentially I-bond them out, release them on their own recognizance, or you know, something approximating that, minor. How many stories do we have to tell of repeat offenders on bail who commit a violent crime that could have otherwise been prevented if they weren't being turnstiled out of the justice system? It's just remarkable. So think of where Chicago is at today and think of the profile that has been inflicted upon Chicago for the last 40 years by the Chicago Press Corps with respect to Flager. And as I said, throw in Jackson, throw in Farrakhan, throw in all the politicians they support and who support them. And what do you have to show for it? And let me just say this, too, about the sexual abuse allegation. I will give Father Flager the benefit of the doubt. I have no reason to believe that allegation is true. I know nothing about the allegation. There's been no reporting of the allegation. I am suspect of an allegation that is that old, given all that the allegations that have been leveled against priests in the Catholic Church over the last 40 years, that it would take this long. Perhaps it's true.
Yeah, remember that allegation against Bernadine that turned out to be false? And he forgave the person who wrongly accused him. And I thought that was the most loving Christian thing a person can do.
And there are other such instances of false allegation. So I will absolutely give him the benefit of the doubt. He absolutely deserves the presumption of innocence. But since he's in the news, let's talk about it. Because if Father Flager is not guilty of this alleged crime, he is guilty of so much else that is relevant to, you know, the larger Chicagoland community who has been largely asleep at the switch for Father Flager's for the entirety of Father Flager's tenure at St. Sabina. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Tom in Deer Park.
Yeah, Dan and Amy, good morning. Echo all that. Told the call screener, much as I loathe Father Flager for all the above reasons. When he appeals, Dan, listened to you on the radio way back when, you're the first person to actually take it apart. Media, instead of telling things the way they were, always covered for him and used them. And going back on your show from day one, you've always made the correct call on him. But to these allegations, to what you said, Amy Bernadine, and 40 years.
40
he's not
years.
The only Catholic priest. He's not the only Catholic priest in the Archdiocese going through this now. And I don't know the facts. And I don't know that we'll ever know the facts, because when you want to go back 40 years, kind of hard to prove false negatives and things like that. But I sense a lottery ticket movement attacking the priest and the archdiocese. Again, I don't know, and I'll be the first to admit it, you know, if that's true. But when you make allegations like this against somebody and you cannot demonstrate that they're false, it just tars it. And if you want to get rid of flagrant, do it for all the above reasons, not for some nasty accusation. And thank you for taking my call.
Well, and he makes money for the church. Tom, I mean, every weekend he'll make $30,000 plus in donations through his sermons and the people in his community that donate to him. But I'm very circumspect about the 40-year. Why, if you're a victim, why would you wait that long to come forward? You know, I mean, wouldn't you want justice
it's
right away?
It's imponderable. It's an imponderable.
And we don't know if it's a kid. No. We don't know if it's a woman or a child, a female or a male. We don't know. All we know is that he met with Supich yesterday for two hours.
No.
Face-to-face he met.
Per the letter, the allegation is from somebody who at least was a minor at the time.
Right. I'm sorry. But we don't know if it's a male or female. Just
correct.
A child. Yes.
Yeah. So, right. Rather than speculating on what we don't know, let's focus on what we do know about Father Flager is my point. Sticking on the criminal justice beat for a minute, it is important to note that the Kenosha County District Attorney, Michael Gravely, announced yesterday that the officers who responded to a call for help and ultimately got into a tussle with Jacob Blake, shot Jacob Blake, who is now still recovering from his injuries, but obviously survived them, that they will not be charged in that shooting.
And we're learning more, too, that he was armed. Because even the night before, when they had a protesting, they shot an unarmed man. Not true. And they provided, I thought they laid out their case beautifully. It was 2 hours long, the press conference. I watched every minute of it and had pictures to show people, yes, he was armed.
Very important. Jacob Blake, while actively resisting, arms himself with a knife. I continue to hear, I think I heard at the rally last night, the vigil, where someone again said he was unarmed. It is absolutely incontrovertible that Jacob Blake was armed with a knife during this encounter. Uncontrovertible. Most uncontrovertible because Jacob Blake, in all of the times he spoke to DCI, admits he possessed a knife. Even tells us at different times he had the knife in different hands at different times. So he arms himself with a knife and refuses to drop that knife. And I know that knife is not easily visible in the video, but we're going to show it to you in a minute.
And then they, you know, still framed it.
That was established. That he was reaching for a knife, the Department of Justice, that he admitted he was in possession of a knife. That was established within the time frame when all of this transpired.
Right, but people didn't listen, Dan. And they could, well, with a narrative like, hands up, don't shoot with Michael Brown, and that he was unarmed.
Yes. Yes. And if you want to inform the willfully blind about the Michael Brown shooting, then go see What Killed Michael Brown, Shelby and Eli Steele's documentary. And the facts are the facts. Are there going to be people that persist in a narrative that runs counter to the facts? Yes, there are. We know this to be true. But something else about this. Jacob Blake is not a good person.
No.
Or at least he has engaged in a lot of not good behavior, including to the woman whose home he showed up in when this incident occurred. But this, speaking of justice, would have been more interesting to probe the district attorney's plea agreement with Jacob Blake than to spend a lot of time on what should be obvious. And that's the way I would have framed it. Obviously, the officers are not going to be charged. Obviously, because it is obvious. 2 years probation, Jacob Blake, after reaching a plea agreement on the charges that resulted in the attempt to arrest him for violating a restraining order. So he had been charged a month earlier with third-degree sexual assault, which is a felony, two misdemeanors for trespassing and disorderly conduct in connection with a fight at his girlfriend's home a month earlier. Then he resists arrest. He jeopardizes the life of the officer, at least the officer that was trying to pull him from getting into his car and getting to that knife. That's, by definition, he jeopardized his life because the officer had reasonable fear for his life, which is why he opened fire, and reasonable fear for his kids who were in the car.
Right, and I said that from the beginning, and you guys, I kept saying, what about the children? There were three kids in that car. If he got in that vehicle with the knife that he still possessed after being tased three times, they didn't. First of all, it wasn't his car. He didn't have permission to take it, and the kids were in there. What, are they going to go on a high-speed chase with him with three kids in the car?
So the charges that were pending against him a month before this occurred, in addition to his conduct the day of, and under a plea deal with prosecutors, two misdemeanor counts of disorderly conduct involving domestic abuse, he's got 2 years of probation.
Yeah.
Is that a proper sentence?
Well, the problem prosecutors had is that the woman who he allegedly molested and sexually assaulted, she dropped the charges against him. Because remember, guys, he still has $2+ million from the GoFundMe page. So I don't know if that played a part in this with her dropping the charges against him, but money is, you know, the root of all evil.
And no, the love of money is the root of all evil, not money.
Well, here's gravely on the fact that the kids were in the car.
Officer Shesky says, and I'm quoting or trying my best to quote him, I don't know what he's going to do. Is he going to hurt the child? Is he going to take off in the vehicle? Are we going to be in a vehicle pursuit with a kid in the car? Will he hold the child hostage? All of these things are things he is considering. They're running through his mind when he puts himself in harm's way and grabs the T-shirt of Jacob Blake. At that same time, let me just say, first of all, a use of force expert, Noble Ray, finds that decision to re-engage based on the factors that Shesky cited in my quote, use of force expert Noble Ray has made the finding that was a reasonable decision to re-engage at that time.
And so, District Attorney Gravely, why wasn't he charged with felony assault,
right,
felony resisting arrest, felony battery of a police officer? Why has he only got a 2-year probation? Why is the plea agreement 2 years of probation? I don't think that's a just sentence for Jacob Blake.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. His family, of course, they spoke. Here's his dad.
There's no justification what was done to my son.
Yeah, there was.
Because your story was you were afraid that my son was going to kidnap his children.
That's right.
If he was fearful of that, why did he fire into the car? So, with the children in the car. Mm-hmm. So it's either going to be, you're not going to keep flip-flopping. This is not hopscotch. This is not ping pong. This is my son, man.
Yeah, okay. His dad defending his son, fine. But obviously that is a silly defense that he offers. He didn't shoot into the car indiscriminately. He had Jacob Blake right in front of him reaching down for a knife, and he shot him in the back. That's not the same thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't put the children in any more harm's way than Jacob Blake did by initiating this altercation with police. I mean, it's just silly.
He just didn't have to resist arrest. I mean, it's so simple. It's so obvious.
It's exhausting is what it is.
They fired John 7 shots and 3 hit him.
John and Piatone.
Good morning. Yes. You got to keep in mind that had they incarcerated him or charged him or whatever, the taxpayers would be responsible for his medical care, which obviously is going to be quite expensive. The best thing for them to do is to cut him loose. If he was wrong, cut him loose, let him deal with it on his own so we don't have to pay for him.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
I don't think so, John. Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, first of all, we have no idea who paid for those medical bills, private health insurance and the Blake family. I have no idea. Who knows? I mean, it could be Medicaid eligible, so he may be paying for it anyway. Number one. Number two, I want people prone to habitual violence like Jacob Blake off the streets. And I want people who put police officers' lives at risk, put their children's lives at risk, assault their girlfriend, whether she drops the charges or not. We know who Jacob Blake is.
Right.
I want them off the streets, and I want to send a message to other violent individuals that violence will land you in a place where you may be on the receiving end of violence. And I'm not talking about probation and being allowed to operate in civil society. I'm talking about being behind bars. There's a message sending here about violent activity, of which Jacob Blake has multiple examples. So no, you know, spending a few bucks to keep predators behind bars for proportional sentences is part of criminal justice. It's also part of living in a free society if you want that society to be safe as well.
Well, these officers are going to be sued in civil court. I mean, they got off of criminal charges, but that's going to happen next. Just ridiculous. And it shouldn't. And any sound jury should watch, look at the evidence and vote in favor of the officers.
Will and Skokie.
Hey, guys. You know, that the lawyer was sitting there talking about how there's three justice systems. He's true. There's one for normal people. There's one for minorities who can appeal to leftist groups and other people to send them millions of dollars into GoFundMe cases. And then there's the third for police officers who usually wind up getting screwed by everybody because they're political. You know, people won't back them up. In this case, I think the DA was great. The problem is that most people don't really know the law. And they think, oh, he got shot multiple times, therefore he's wrong. And that's not true. All right? Got a good.
Thanks for the call, Will.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Trump supporters gathering on the mall today. Yes. Rally to Save America. If you're, maybe you happen to be listening to the show on our app. If you are out in D.C., give us a call, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. 646-360-A, turnkey.pro text line. I know I got a number of friends out there.
Yeah, my sister wishes she could be out there, but she can't because she has this thing called a job that she has to go to. But people are upset. I mean, and a lot of people think that today's the day, that today the results of the election are going to be overturned. And I've been trying to tell them that probably is not going to happen. In fact, that is not going to happen. And I don't think I'm off in my assessment of that.
Well, before we even get to that, characterization of those Republican senators and House members, but particularly senators who are planning to lodge objections, as has so been articulated over the last several days by both Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz and Ron Johnson, sparring with that yapping terrier Chuck Todd and Meet the Press. Well, here's the unifying that will occur under a Biden administration. Here is the D.C. press corps, the comm shop for the Democrat Socialists, you know, helping to paper over our divisions in advance of a Biden administration, putting the ugliness of the Trump years behind us. I give you Assistant Washington Post editor Eugene Robinson on, where else would he be, Morning Joe.
The Hawley and Cruz and the rest of the Dirty Dozen, or I guess there are 14 of them now, should live in eternal shame for what they're doing, because they're damaging not just Democrats, and they're certainly, I hope, not improving their odds of ever becoming president. I think they should wear some sort of scarlet letter for the rest of their political careers, because they're harming the country. They're harming the country in a way that Vladimir Putin hasn't been able to do, that Xi Jinping hasn't been able to do, that the Ayatollahs in Iran have not been able to do. The serial killer is inside the House and inside the Senate and the House of the United States. And this is an appalling situation. And I've covered countries that have lost their democratic traditions and tried to get them back. And it's hard. It doesn't automatically happen. You don't snap your fingers and it all goes back to the way it was before.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Are you supportive of what the Dirty 14, as Eugene Robinson in the Senate, are apt to do today in terms of lodging their objections and having the 2 hours of debate that's provided to the electoral counts in particular states? Or are they irreparably harming democracy, as Eugene Robinson said in his, God, you know, just painfully staged sort of way? But it's interesting to me, the originalists like Eugene Robinson, they're so concerned about the Constitution and abiding the black letter of it. So concerned, sort of generally speaking, with whatever notion they have about our democracy. But the specifics are lacking, as they always seem to be.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, what specifically is the harm that will be done short-term, medium-term, long-term by members of Congress objecting under the provision of federal law, the Electoral Count Act of 1887, objecting to the electors in particular states where there are election irregularities any more than the individuals who protested in the House and Senate protested the 2016, objected to the 2016 electoral outcome or the 2004 electoral outcome, those Democrats, any more than they irreparably damaged, did harm worthy of scarlet letters to our democracy.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
I mean, I understand the arguments pro and con. I understand the point that Tom Cotton has made.
Right.
You know, some of the other senators, it's a little bit less so because they're sort of, you know, competing with Eugene Robinson for on the measure of moral indignation. It's not that impressive. And you know, the heaping moral scorn in lieu of having a substantive argument, that that gambit is getting pretty tired and it's pretty transparent.
Well, to have an electoral commission, don't you need 60 votes from the Senate in order for that to happen? I mean, are the votes even there?
Mm. Well, no, I don't think the votes are there. You would need a majority of the Senate and the House to agree to something like that. That's not going to happen. I mean, I don't know. It's high, anything's possible, but it's highly, highly unlikely. I don't believe there is much of a chance of anything like that. And I think that for the most part, those who've suggested, including our conversation with Andy McCarthy the other day, that what you have is people wanting to make a point about what they think occurred in those states, in addition to serve their own political interests, right, with respect to giving voice to Trump supporters who don't feel like the president has gotten a fair shake and his team have gotten a fair shake with the allegations they've raised.
Right, because the world is watching today.
So it's sort of like the whole rush to confirm the November 3rd results and not even and suggest that every legal move that the Trump campaign made was undermining democracy. So even when they were accessing the courts, that was undermining democracy. That was threatening our democracy. And the more we've gone on this process, the more hyperbolic the D.C. press corps and Democrat socialists, their Democrat socialist friends, have become, really. President Trump or these senators, he's not even talking about Trump, Trump is included by inference, but Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz are doing to our nation what Putin and Xi and the Ayatollahs in Iran can't do. They're destroying the republic from within in a way that our foreign enemies cannot. I mean, that's really what's happening through the suggestion of an electoral commission and sort of a 10-day audit of substantive alleged irregularities that have not been properly vetted, at least arguably properly vetted. if there's the evidentiary support. Like, so, for example, those four batches of ballots that were the topic of the real topic of the call between Trump and Brad Raffensperger in Georgia over the weekend. The more hysterical somebody gets, the more unhinged they are about their position, the more suspect you should be when that's all they offer is invective and general assertions about what will happen. Well, tell me how. How is this being undermined? And if you want to suggest that Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley pose more of a threat to our republic than the dictator in China, Russia, or Iran, then I think that requires a little bit more explanation, Gene. And this is somebody we're supposed to take seriously. I know he's reported on countries where democracy has been unwound. Give us the comparisons, Gene. Please, the floor is yours. The point with all of these people is get them to talk more. Just ask questions. But put them on the spot to have to explain the assertions they're making rather than just, you know, me-tooing their, you know, overheated bloviations, which is what you're getting on these cable talk shows, and these off-the-shelf pundits and media prevaricators. Jason in Northlake, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Okay, so I'll give you the one specific concept that I'm troubled with is the fact that we are, first of all, the Democrats are doing everything in their power to try to get rid of the Electoral College. And in this particular case, we're undermining the Electoral College, or at least bringing it to question, so you can fast forward now into the future as to where you've got your Democratic-controlled Congress, but again, we're talking about a Republican president, where now the Congress, the Democrats, can go and try to use this example as a way of undermining the Electoral College and then try to vote in what they want as their president, as opposed to listening to the Electoral College. That's my one concern.
All right, let me address that concern. Thanks for the call, Jason. I keep hearing that, undermining the Electoral College, undermining the Electoral College. How? We're challenging, those members of the House and Senate are going to challenge the slate of electors in particular states, not because there's anything fundamentally wrong with the Electoral College, but because there was something fundamentally wrong with the administration of the election in those specific states. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So how does that undermine the Electoral College? These are arguments about the administration of elections, the counting of votes at the state level, the suspension of the provisions in the state constitution in Pennsylvania by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. What does that have to do with the Electoral College? Nothing. It's not every state that is being challenged or objected to the outcome. It's specific states where there are specific allegations about specific maladministration. So I just don't buy that undermining the Electoral College is an argument that, or it's just a phrase that people rinse and repeat because, you know, most people are essentially automatons, particularly those that have profile in this society and in media, remarkably, but true. They have no idea what they're talking about. They can't explain their position. So in lieu of that, they just repeat what they heard somebody else repeat on the previous show. And it just builds upon itself. And, you know, as the old saw goes, if you repeat it enough times, and I guess with enough voices, then apparently it magically transubstantiates into an argument. It's not an argument. There's no underlying supporting logic or evidence. You can argue whether it is the Election Count Act of 1887 is actually constitutional. Well, it hasn't been deemed unconstitutional, but you can make that argument. You can argue about, as the president is attempting to argue, that Mike Pence has powers he does not have as the presiding officer over the count today. You can make those arguments. At least the arguments being made, and you go to the jurisprudence and the intent of the framers and so forth. This undermining this and undermining that, How? And what exactly is the argument that actually is being advanced by Ted Cruz and Ron Johnson and Josh Hawley? At least Cruz and Johnson specifically with their proposed audit commission and their along with 10 of their colleagues, 11 of their colleagues, at least they're making a specific case. Ted Cruz laid out a specific case, a specific argument with Maria Bartiromo on Sunday. But this isn't an attack on the Electoral College. It's calling into question how certain states conducted their elections and whether the result is they sent an illegitimate slate of electors to D.C. to be counted. Bob in Edison Park.
Yes, my view on this, Dan and Amy, is where do the Republicans go from here? And what are the Republicans at this point? Are they going to be a thorn in the Biden side? Are they going to have him impeached over the allegations prior to the election that came out? The Republicans had, for 2 years, a majority led by that slime ball, Paul Ryan, and they did nothing with the majority in the House, in the Senate, and in the presidency. I have no faith in the Republican Party as it stands today.
Well, thanks, what did Obama call, do when he was in, you know, he had, the Democrats were in charge of the House and the Senate. He didn't, you know, he didn't help minorities.
He moved Obamacare.
He moved Obamacare, and that was it. That was his main singular focus.
And Trump and House and Senate Republicans moved the tax cuts.
Yeah. Deregulations of small business, which was great.
What is to become of the Republicans? I think that's an open question. I don't know the answer to it. I don't think anybody does. Jeff and Addison.
Hello. Love your show. If there is no fair elections, there is no Electoral College. If you can cheat and get away with it, what's the point of the Electoral College anyway? That's the one thing that separates us from the direct democracy anyway. But
Okay, Jeff. Thanks for the call. But here's what I would say to that. The real question is, if you don't have a state Supreme Court that will abide the state constitution, then what's the point of the state Supreme Court in Pennsylvania? If you don't have a state legislature that will clip the wings of, or a state executive that will clip the wings of administrative agencies that are redefining terms that run afoul of legislative intent, then what's the point of having a legislature or a governor in Wisconsin, for example? I mean, the whole, like, what's the point of having elections? Think about what's the point of having these state executives and state legislative bodies and state courts if you are not going to enforce the state laws or your state constitution? This whole, you know, what's the point argument isn't limited to free and fair elections. Drill down a little bit to where the elections are administered. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Interesting op-ed at thefederalist.com today from a woman named Jenny White explaining why she's joining the D.C. March for Trump today. She's a homeschooling mom of five. She was a former school teacher. She also has a background in epidemiology. She had this to say. I'm angry because I've been playing by the rules, paying my taxes, being civil and tolerant of my neighbor, accepting without protest the election of past presidents I didn't support, and never threatening physical violence, using name-calling, canceling careers, using government goons to unlawfully spy to invent reasons for impeachment, or using media to misreport, misrepresent, or otherwise create dissension and anger. Yet the other side has carte blanche to do all this and more without condemnation, conviction, or retribution of any kind. On January 6th, I will try one more time. that day, today, I will stand with fellow Americans on the Mall in Washington, D.C., where I will once again petition heaven, where I will again hope to see results before I quit for good. I think that represents the feeling of a lot of Americans and a lot of Trump voters. And it speaks to something, you know, not only are they allowed to do things that are inappropriate and improper.
Like loot and take stuff that doesn't belong to you.
Right.
Destroy people's livelihoods.
Yeah, with carte blanche.
Just take it. It's all right.
It's, you know, it's one thing where it's obvious. It's another thing to say where there are no rules. It's another thing to say, well, there are rules, voting procedures, laws, and those rules can just be blithely ignored and be rewritten when opportunity presents itself to do so. Like, for example, the lockdown policies in response to COVID that were the predicate to rewrite how states and particular cities within those states were going to administer their elections. Yeah, that's frustrating when you're playing by the rules and the rule makers are rigging the system against you always. And every time you abide the new set of rules, they change those rules up on you once again, and they suggest you're a bad person if you don't abide the new rules they just made up out of whole cloth to serve their interests at your expense. Yeah, it's a problem.
Wasn't it just so unbelievable when you can break into a store, take what you want, but if you open up your own business, you can get arrested and be charged with trespassing on your own business. Who signed up for this? Nobody.
Well, for more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Professor Klaus Rinn. He's a professor of politics. He's founding director of the New Center for the Study of Statesmanship at the Catholic University of America. He has books including A Common Human Ground and America the Virtuous, and he penned a column for American Conservative, How the 2020 Election Could Have Been Stolen. Professor Rinn, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So in your piece, you essentially looked at some of the statistical anomalies and suggested that, that's indicative of something exceptional that occurred, and we don't have an explanation that meets the level of how exceptional these events were that transpired on November 3rd.
Yeah, something paradoxical happened. Political scientists like to predict things. They want to come up with ways of predicting the outcome of an election, and they will say things like, well, the way Ohio goes, so goes the presidency. And, of course, that's a very rough rule of thumb sort of measurement, but they can become very detailed in this regard, and so they will expand the idea and say, well, you can't win the presidency without Florida and Ohio. And if you want to be really certain who the winner is going to be, look at how things turn out in Florida and Ohio and Iowa. Now, these are states that are roughly a reflection of the general population of the United States. And what happened in this election is that Donald Trump easily won each of these states. He won Florida by 3%. He won Ohio, the state without which presumably you cannot become president, by 8%. He won Iowa with 8%. Now, somebody might then argue, well, that might be a fluke, unexpected paradoxical things do happen. Well, if you then go to the more granular level, you can look at certain bellwether counties spread out in the United States, states or counties, rather, that political scientists have identified as virtually always going with a winner. And they've done so for a long time. And they had identified 19 counties in particular, which tend to go with a winner. And those 19 counties
if you look at them this year, presented a rather striking pattern. Now, since Biden won the presidency, supposedly, you would expect that he would have won the brunt of those counties. Now, according to the political scientists, if you win, let's say, 15 or 16 of those counties, it's virtually assured that the person who won those counties would win the presidency. Well, what is curious, very paradoxical about this particular measure is that Donald Trump won 18 of those 19 bellwether counties, those very competitive counties, and he won them by a good margin. I could go into detail on this, but I don't
Well, here's the thing. Yeah, so right. So the anomaly is, and the other anomaly is he underperformed Hillary Clinton in major metropolitan areas, except the major metropolitan areas in the states he needed. So Philadelphia, Milwaukee, Atlanta, Phoenix, so I guess there's one question is, you know, for some of the anomalies, is there an explanation based on sort of the general demographic composition of the Trump electorate versus the Biden electorate? And this is how you could explain the 18 of 19 counties, for example, or Iowa and Ohio, for example.
These counties have been selected as being representative somehow of the population as a whole.
50-50 counties.
And so, yes, these are very competitive counties, mm-hmm. and some of them have voted for the president since the 1800s. Now, the fact that they've done it for a long time by itself does not give them particular predictive value, but it tells you something when these counties, which are largely representative of the country as a whole, go in one direction. Except the trend is dramatically reversed in just those states that Biden simply had to win in order to carry the presidency.
And then the other question would be, these are definitely anomalies, but you had a deus ex machina event, and that was COVID-19. And we administer an election in a way we've never done before. And so it was bound to produce anomalies, or certainly it could help explain why these anomalies occurred that don't implicate voter fraud.
Well, that's a rather weak argument, because they certainly had COVID in those 19 counties. There's nothing weird about those counties. On the contrary, they have proven to be over the decades reliably voting the same way as the country as a whole. What is curious here is that it is in the big cities, in the battleground states, that the American electorate somehow reverses course. That is, Biden underperformed percentage-wise relative to Hillary Clinton, and he underperformed quite a bit relative to Obama, but not in the battleground states. Mm-hmm. So that you have something that is more than a paradox, something that political scientists have great difficulty coming up with an explanation for.
And so what do your colleagues who say there's no evidence of systemic fraud say about these anomalies? What's their explanation?
Well, I can't speak for anybody except myself.
Well, you hear arguments, or you hear that statement. I don't hear the logical argument behind that statement. I just hear that sort of dismissive statement. There's no evidence of systemic voter fraud, and so I don't have to answer the question about anomalies. Have you heard any good arguments about anomalies?
Well, the arguments about anomalies are everywhere. Now, it's too early for me, who I'm trying to exercise some critical distance here, to say in any definite way exactly how much there is to the various charges, but that there are charges and that there are some very mystifying events. That's beyond the shadow of a doubt. And it seems to me to be disturbing, even ominous, that the American media, with very, very few exceptions, have not bothered to look into any of these charges. They always say that these are unproven allegations, unsupported. Well, that indicates either ignorance or refusal to consider the evidence. I mean, merely what I've just been telling you about the anomaly of voting patterns across the United States is by itself reason to be curious, mighty curious, as to what would explain this.
Well, then how did they steal the election? Give me something concrete.
Well, there are charges galore. I do not claim to know enough about, I'm not a computer geek. I'm not even an advanced statistician. But any number of people who have looked at the outcomes in the big cities in the battleground states are mighty curious. It so happens that when I started really to collect my thoughts about what happened in the election, I read one series of articles that was published in all countries, in Sweden of all countries. Now, Europe is even more disdainful of Trump than the media are in the United States, even more disdainful. And here was this article by a statistician, three articles, whose main theme was something very curious happened in this American election. This is only days after the results have been announced. This is statistically inexplicable. Here's somebody who's sitting over there in Sweden who notices these things, but the media think there's nothing to see here. It's an almost preposterous situation. It has to make any critical person very, very suspicious.
I suppose
now, we all know about various court cases. I mean, all of that has been prepared for just a few weeks, and much of that material that's being presented is very hard to understand for people who are not geeks and who are not statisticians. But that there is material galore to explore, I think, is beyond a doubt.
Yeah, and I guess we're just supposed to accept the company line that Joe Biden punched a lottery ticket with respect to all these anomalies. That seems to be where we're at. Klaus Rinn, professor of politics and founding director of the New Center for the Study of Statesmanship at Catholic University of America. Books include America the Virtuous and A Common Human Ground. Professor Rinn, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, we're talking about the gathering at the mall in D.C. today, and one of our friends, I'm sure many of our friends are out there, but one called in. Chris, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer. How is it in D.C.?
It's doing well, Dan. Good morning. How are you?
Good. Give us a lay of the land.
Well, listen to CNN, you'd probably say there's about three dozen people here, but I can confirm there are four. Probably about a million. I'm standing on Constitution Avenue between the Washington National Monument and the Ellipse, looking at the stage with the two jumbotrons, and it's picking up pretty quickly. Folks are out here the wee hours of the night, and daybreak has broken here, and the weather's good. People are enthusiastic and happy to be here to support our president.
Are you excited to see Trump?
Very, very. Things are sitting off here at the Ellipse, and then there's going to be a bigger, say, get-together over by the steps of the Congress at about 1 o'clock. We'll be migrating that in that direction at that time.
Are there any, you see any, like, counter-protests or any antagonism from the Antifa types or other leftists?
Not at all. Not at all.
absolutely packed. There are Trump flags and American flags everywhere. And there's been absolutely no indication of any kind of turmoil. More than likely, this area will probably be cleaner than when we got here, given the group of folks that are here.
There you go. Chris, thanks so much for calling. Have fun out there. We appreciate it.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. When you've got... always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This morning, Raphael Warnock posted a video declaring victory over Kelly Loeffler in his Senate race in Georgia, which the AP has called for Warnock. And just a few moments ago, John Ossoff, who is up about 16,000 votes, and David Perdue in the other Senate race, posted a video. Again, Loeffler has not conceded, and nobody's even called the race for Ossoff yet.
Good morning. It is with humility that I thank the people of Georgia for electing me to serve you in the United States Senate. Thank you for the confidence and trust that you have placed in me. At this moment of crisis, as COVID-19 continues to ravage our state and our country, when hundreds of thousands have lost their lives, millions have lost livelihoods, Georgia families are having difficulty putting food on the table, fearing foreclosure or eviction, having difficulty making ends meet. Let's unite now to beat this virus and rush economic relief to the people of our state and to the...
There you go. Let's get reaction to both of these occurrences from our friend Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist, Trumponomics author, economist Steve Moore. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Do I have to?
I don't know. How are you feeling today?
Bad. Happy New Year to you guys. It was a catastrophic election for the Republicans. No, there's no sugarcoating this. And this one, well, I think there was rampant fraud in the November elections, and that may very well have cost Trump the election. You can't blame this one on voter fraud. There was a lot of voter security here. Why did it happen?
I think that Republicans exhausted or something? What happened?
I think Trump, and I love Donald Trump, but his behavior since the election has been, to put it kindly, erratic. And I think that has been, the phone call that happened 4 or 5 days ago with the Georgia Secretary of State was just improper. And I think it cost the Republicans a lot of votes in very close elections.
Steve, just a second there. So Perdue wins or has 88,000 more votes than Ossoff on November 3rd, and that was the two of them had the overwhelming majority. It wasn't such a big primary like Loeffler and Warnock had.
Interrupt you for 1 second there, Dan. One of the tragedies for the Republicans is he came within 1,000 points of winning outright.
I know.
He was right there.
I'm like, this is a curse. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, but so he's up. He wins by, he has more than 88,000 votes more than Ossoff on November 3rd, and he's down 16,000 now. You think that's all attributable to a Saturday phone call with Raffensperger?
No. I think it was a confluence of factors. I think that Trump's behavior the last few days and weeks has hurt the Republicans. He basically, and look, I don't want to blame Trump for this. The other thing that happened was that the left spent a gargantuan amount of money here. They spent about $500 million on two Senate races, which is, off the charts. That's what we used to spend on presidential races. So it was a massive amount of money, a massive turnout machine by the Democrats. They outworked the Republicans. They outspent them. And, it's a tragedy for the Republicans. This isn't Michigan or Pennsylvania or Massachusetts. This is Georgia. Georgia has been a reliably red state for 50 years. So, it's a hard one to swallow. And I think it's a repudiation of Republicans. Plus, the other thing I was going to mention was that $2,000 checks. Trump started talking about, you know, giving everybody $2,000 checks, and that put the Senate, it split the Republicans right down the middle. And that's a stupid idea, by the way. It's just sending people more free money is not the solution to our problems. It's going to make the problems worse, not better. And yet Democrats seized on that and, you know, basically promised everybody $2,000 if they voted for them. And,
well, what about Loeffler and Purdue? I mean, the stock trades that they made, you know, right before the pandemic hit or during the pandemic, that didn't sit well with a lot of people. And I, you know, spent time in Georgia and Atlanta. Yep. Every single commercial, every head was about their stock trades.
Yeah, that's a good point, Amy. And, you know, those kinds of, I don't think that it was what they did was improper, but it's certainly the visuals didn't look good. And so I think that hurt, too. No doubt about it. You know, Purdue has been a really good senator. He's going to be very missed. He was a really strong free market pro-business senator. And you know, look, this is a bad day for the country, I believe. I mean, these two Democrats are not, you know, this isn't Sam Nunn. Remember Sam Nunn? You know,
yeah, of course.
An old, you know, moderate Democrat, Southern moderate Democrat. These guys will be
radical.
You know, Warnock may be the left of Bernie Sanders, for goodness sakes. And they ran as left-wing liberals. They didn't run away from their left-wing. You know, so, you know, maybe the country has shifted a little bit left. I don't know. I mean,
what happens to Mitch McConnell?
Yeah.
Good question. I mean, you know, McConnell, one of the reasons this is important, you know, just in terms of policy is that, you know, whether you like Mitch McConnell or don't like him, he's an incredible parliamentarian. And he would have been able, as a majority leader, just block almost all of the bad things that, you know, that Joe Biden wants to do. And now that he doesn't have the gavel, it's going to bring a lot of these bills to the floor that, you know, we as conservatives are not going to like very much. And some of them are going to be very harmful. And, you know, I'll say this. I think that all of this talk, I mean, they were already talking last night about, oh, we're going to give all these free things to people, more money, more aid, more rent assistance, more this, that. You know, this is the dependency culture that the Democrats are going to build up again, which, by the way, the people who are hurt the most by the dependency culture are the very minorities and low-income people that are supposed to be helped.
Well, there's no question about that. And Purdue is still an outstanding issue, much more so an outstanding issue than Loeffler,
yeah,
I think.
It doesn't look good, but, you know.
No, I understand.
I
prefer you with up 16,000 than down 16,000. I get it.
That's right. But, I mean, again, you're right. It's not over, but it's unlikely.
But with respect to McConnell, he also seems to have lost perhaps the control he once enjoyed over the caucus, as evidenced by what's going to transpire today with a dozen senators over his objections. And I wonder if Mitch McConnell wants to be the minority leader or his caucus wants him to be their minority leader.
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't think we were really expecting to lose these two Senate races. I mean, I knew the Loeffler race would be really close, but I thought Purdue would, you know, win pretty handily. I mean, Ossoff is a doofus. But it wasn't really about them, though. It was about a kind of a reaction to the post-election environment that's been kind of toxic. Then the question, who would it be? You know, who would be the minority leader? I think the next in line would be John Thune. I don't know if he's as skilled as McConnell in terms of his parliamentary, you know, knowledge and so on. But I don't know. We're all just kind of picking up the pieces right now, Dan. So it's hard to really see where things go from here. You know, Schumer will be this majority leader. And, you know, you got the murderer's row now, folks. You got Biden in the White House. You got Pelosi, who we call her Madam Pelosi, but we're, you know, Madam Speaker, but we're not allowed to do that anymore.
No, you can't. Use mother either.
But,
way, it works so hard,
Amy,
to be mom.
Amy, what do you think about this stuff about me? You can't call someone a grandmother
or a mother? Are you kidding me? Who are they to determine how we speak and whatever happened to freedom of speech? And it's just ridiculous.
Exactly.
It's so stupid and silly, and that they'd even spend time on passing a measure like that is bothersome.
It's just a little. I 100% agree, but it's more than just symbolic. These people are crazy.
They're morons.
Crazy people. Yeah. We're taking over Washington, and they really believe that you know, people want to get rid of the words grandmother and mother, and they really think that that's somehow, you know, defamatory to people to say that. I mean,
I know it's not a derogatory term. It's your mother. I mean, who doesn't love their mother?
Exactly.
On matters economics, Steve, it turns out that lockdowns are surprisingly anti-growth. ADP, that's surprising to some, to many, it would appear. ADP reporting this morning that payrolls down 123,000 unexpectedly in December.
Yep, it's lockdown. You know, this is the season. You know, these were the late December numbers, and this is usually, you know, a big pickup of employment, you know, with people out going shopping, and, you know, none of people can go to restaurants. People can go to bars. You know, the restaurant and bar industry does massive amounts of their, you know, their profits are made, you know, between Thanksgiving and New Year's, and that was all shut down. And the lockdowns have been real damage, and we are kind of two Americas right now with states like, I mean, I told you guys that normally the Moore family would travel to, you know, the Chicago area, and we'd be on Miracle Mile, and we'd spend a lot of money on restaurants and food and shops and all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, we stayed home this year because everything was shut down.
Time the Moore family comes and next time the Moore family comes to Chicago, you're not going to be able to shop at Macy's either.
Yeah, Macy's is gone on the Mag Mile. Did you hear?
Is it? Yeah, and that was one of the signature, you know, stores there. So we have to stop the lockdowns. I mean, the evidence continues to come in. I mean, you know what state has the biggest increase in coronavirus cases right now by far?
California.
Yeah, and guess what? California's been locked down for the last month and a half.
Right. So
they're
not
locked
working.
Down tight enough. More lockdown.
Yeah, exactly.
No, that's what the politicians will say.
They probably will. And, you know, that's the other thing to worry about with the Democrats taking over. The Democrats are pro-lockdown, and I really worry about national, you know, requirements of locking down stores and curfews and things of that nature that will be very injurious, not just to the economic health of the country, but to our civil liberties. So, you know, I hate to start off
yeah.
the new year.
Things are going great.
Well, the good news is, Steve, the economic damage is just visited on people that are not important. The important people are fine, so
yeah,
don't worry too much
about
it.
Well,
security.
You know, that's the other big thing that went on here, guys, is that the, you know, you asked me why did the Republicans lose this race, and we have to do the autopsy, and it'll take some time to do, but one thing is clear. I mean, the big tech companies and the executives, they spent tens and tens of millions of dollars, in some cases, hundreds of millions of dollars on these races. I mean, big tech, and by the way, I'm not one who wants to, you know, censor big tech or, you know, I'm not in favor of breaking up big tech. But, you know, these folks who made billions and billions and billions of dollars, in some cases, trillions of dollars up of the free enterprise system, Dan, they're trying to tear it down. You know, I don't get it.
He is Steve Moore, author of Trumponomics, economist, Wall Street Journal columnist. Steve, thanks for joining us. Go lick your wounds. Yes.
I'll be in a better mood next week, I promise.
All right.
Okay. Maybe we won't, though. And Stephen Moore joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and the topic, vaccine distribution. How are the vaccinations going state by state? Well, there's some suggestion that there's a bit of confusion in New York State, where St. Andrew of COVID-19 is the governor. Interviews with multiple county officials in New York State over the past week confirm many are unclear why the governor's administration has not activated the county-by-county system, a plan that included recent practice sessions in which members of the public received regular flu vaccines at drive-thru sites. In Albany County, officials have privately said they could vaccinate the population of the southern half of the county in a few days if they were given the coronavirus vaccines and allowed to mobilize their plan. Huh. And yet, I haven't heard any pointed questions in the direction of St. Andrew of COVID-19. But there was a pointed question on vaccines and the distribution and the efficacy of said, directed at Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida by fungible CNN reporter. Her name is not important. And this is how that went. Ron DeSantis is, I think, a more polished version of Trump when it comes to dealing with the press. This is highly entertaining. At least it was for me. I hope it is for you.
Governor, what has gone wrong with the rollout of the vaccine that we've seen phone lines jammed, websites crashing?
It's a lot of demand. I mean, I think at the end of the day,
if I could finish my question.
You just said what has gone wrong, so I'm answering the question.
If I could complete the question, though.
So are you going to give a speech or are you going to ask a question?
With all due respect, Governor,
you asked the question, I'm going
to
answer it.
To finish my
question. You're giving a speech. You asked a question.
I am trying to ask you the.
You're going to ask how many questions? You get three? They only got one question. Why do you get three?
With all due respect, Governor, I'm just asking if I could finish my question.
You didn't. You finished the question.
I did not. My full question is, what went wrong with the rollout of the vaccine when we've seen phone lines jammed, websites
crashing? So
you're
repeating your question.
To complete it for you, Governor, we've seen websites crash and also senior citizens waiting overnight for the vaccine.
Where was that at?
We've seen it in Duval, Broward, Orange, and Lee County.
And why was, why did that happen? Did you investigate why?
That's my question to you, Governor. You're the governor of the state. I'm not the governor of the state.
Okay, but you didn't investigate why that happened, in Lee County. Why was there a big line? Did you investigate why?
Could you tell us why?
Because we distributed vaccine to hospitals, and the hospital said, first come, first serve. If you show up, we'll do it. So they didn't use a registration system. There wasn't anything that was done, and there's a lot of demand for it. So people are going to want to go ahead and get it.
So are you saying there was no plan then from the state to make sure that senior citizens didn't wait outside overnight?
So the state is not dictating to hospitals we're not dictating to Carlos Mongoya how he runs his operations here. That would be a total disaster. These guys are much more competent to be able to deliver healthcare services than a state government could ever be.
Wow. Drop mic, go home.
Well, it's just a great tutorial about, it's really a discussion of subsidiarity, but of course that's a bit esoteric for general consumption. The idea that, hey, look, it's the DeSantis disposition and then the disposition of a number of other governors, Christine Ohm in South Dakota, Brian Kemp, really generally in Georgia, which is say, like, what we place our trust in our constituents to be sensible. We're trying to get people the resources they need, whether they're the medical professionals or their staff at nursing homes and long-term care facilities, or they're the residents of those facilities themselves. We're following a progression, but we need partners here. This idea, the state has a plan and then a wand is waved and everything just is implemented without wrinkle or incident, is the sort of magical thinking that exists in the D.C. press corps. Ron DeSantis exists in the real world, where he needs partners, including in the private sector, to get the job
done. Right. U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams yesterday said, hey, governors, ask CVS, ask Walgreens to help you roll out this plan. The vaccines are there. Let's do it.
For more on this topic, we're pleased now to be joined by Eric Hargan. He is the Deputy Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. Eric, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good to be here.
So, last month, but just before Christmas, when Secretary Azar was on the Sunday talk, he's talking about the vaccine distribution and going back and forth with the likes of Margaret Brennan on the topic. He sort of suggested the system that had been set up and the metrics they think that could be met, with the caveat there that, you know, because of these are state and local matters, we're drilling down to states and localities and their partners at the local level. There are going to be unanticipated wrinkles. But he was talking about 20 million vaccinations by the end of December, 100 million by the end of February. It doesn't seem like that's where we're on track for at present. And so how do you respond to how things are going and if those goals are still realistic?
Well, you know, there is 20 million doses sort of being shipped to the states and delivered to them. You know, I think that we have been on track in terms of both the delivery, the production of the vaccine doses by the companies, and the allocation and shipping and delivery. There's always sort of a lag between allocation and the shipping and delivery. Then delivery and administration of the vaccine, and then administration and then the report of the vaccine, because there's sort of four steps here before we know what the vaccines, how many vaccines have actually gotten in people's arms, because there's another person doing the reporting at the end of that chain telling us, and then we tell everyone. So they, at the beginning of that step, yes, that's fine. We're shipping the vaccine doses exactly where the states and the other jurisdictions are telling us to ship them. Those are going out the door. And so the work that to ship the vaccines to those locations, we think is going pretty well, thanks to the work of General Pernas's team here, Operation Warp Speed. So that, I think now we get down to the level of like, where are the vaccines being administered? And there's a tremendous variation. The states, we've been sort of put out a template plan in September for the states to adapt to. They gave us all their plans. They looked fine, but of course there's always implementation issues. And we see a real big difference. I mean, you have states like South Dakota, North Dakota, Connecticut, Maine, they all are reporting, you know, 60-70% of the doses delivered. And that's obviously rolling distribution. You know, we're putting out doses all the time as the production comes in. You have states that are kind of in the middle, and then states that are reporting, you know, less than 25% of delivered doses. So, you know, we've got a tremendous variation between those hitting, you know, 70% marks, like South Dakota, and those like Virginia that are currently reporting less than 25% of delivered doses. And again, putting, you know, there might be a gap in the reporting, but you got a big swing there.
Well, how can like CVS and Walgreens help out?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you look, we put out, you know, some guidance there and some protections for them, pharmacists and their pharmacy techs, to make sure that they wouldn't be subject to liability. That was one of the issues. But I think CVS and Walgreens, they, or any private partners that are used to administering doses, would be potentially great partners for the states to look to. You know, when they see that sort of doses are being stopped up in a particular area, or there's not, you know, one of the places they had indicated to do the dosing is not efficiently carrying that out for whatever reason. There could be any number of reasons for that. That's really why we look to the states and localities to look at these. They're going to have that more particular information, certainly better. They're better situated than we are here in Washington to know what those kinks are in the distribution system and to say, we need to get those doses back, or put, you know, sort of fix the area where you're seeing kinks in the system, or get them, you know, sort of change your direction. You've seen that in Florida. You've seen that in Georgia, announced plans for them to kind of shift and get those vaccines out. You know, when events happen and you see the plans, you know, as they say, you know, plan only survives until it meets, you know, reality. When they saw the plans, that's when you adapt on the fly. And you see leaders like Governor DeSantis that are able to adapt on the fly and start changing their, you know, changing their plans to make sure you get the most number of the doses of vaccine out the door and in people's arms, which is the goal.
And so for those states that do have kinks in the distribution system, as you're describing, the HHS is in contact with them. There's a dialogue. There's a back and forth in terms of trying to remedy whatever the problems are.
Well, they reach out to us, but, you know, in many cases, what they are going to be doing is reaching out to those local distributors and those local institutions that we ship them to do that directly. We're always available and have been talking with them about potential issues, information that we have, advice we can give. But there's a gap between that, what we do in Washington, and really what we look to being done on the ground, you know, at a particular hospital or at a particular clinic. Where state and local authorities are going to have far more information and be more efficient about dealing with those issues when they get the information there. We're always happy to help. We've been helping all along, helping them, you know, through CDC and others, trying to help them get their plans together. But obviously we're seeing a varying, as one would expect on a country as big as ours and as, you know, with so many different circumstances, we're seeing a lot of differences among the states in their ability to get those doses out the door efficiently into people's arms.
With respect to the vaccinations, does HHS have any perspective on this this argument between those who are promoting a first doses first approach to vaccination, suggesting that that basically two vaccinated people confers more immunity than one double vaccinated person, and that there shouldn't be stockpiles being held back for the second doses for individuals who got a first dose vaccination? You should be vaccinating as many people as you can with that first dose and then continuing to ramp up production as you need to get the second doses out. So there seems to be a disagreement about approach there, and I wonder where HHS is at on it.
Well, I don't think that we – so, for example, the clinical trials that were done for these vaccines did not indicate – they didn't do a kind of a real scrub on the difference between one and two doses. We do have – you know, there's some provisional thoughts about that, about what kind of – what protection people have seen between one dose versus two doses. We know what the two-dose numbers are because the clinical trial was done with that in mind, was the first shot plus the booster. So that's, and there have been thoughts about obviously put all the doses out there. But if you had a shutdown in production between that first and second dose, and you found that the protection was waning because the first dose wasn't enough for more permanent protection or high enough, then we would be in a worse situation where we hadn't held those doses back and instead had a situation where maybe the production wouldn't keep up, or maybe there would be, you know, anything can happen with production. If you've been around enough, you see any situation where a plant, something goes wrong with the power supply or anything that can go into a plant, and you just don't want to be in that situation. From a prudential point of view, you don't want to be in that situation. So hence the holdback and proceeding as the clinical trials, as the data had said, two doses for these first two. Obviously, we have vaccines coming up. We've got vaccines in the last stage of clinical trials. We may see some upside surprises from some of the vaccines that are in late stage clinical trials. That could happen soon, honestly, with some of the candidates. But again, that would be an upside surprise. In that case, we're going to have access to more vaccines, hopefully.
And that means Johnson & Johnson, right? Because their vaccine is only one dose instead of two.
Exactly. And so you got a one-dose vaccine potentially, which is in the last stage of clinical trials. And so, you know, as we gather information about it, obviously, you know, hopefully that works out and we can start bringing even more capacity online if that works out. We've got it in AstraZeneca in last stage of clinical trials and several other vaccines that are also out there, thankfully. Waiting in the wings. In the meantime, we have to, you know, use the production capacity from the first two companies. It was frankly a miracle that they got those done. I think that's what was predicted by the press. It would take a miracle. But we have it. But we also want to make sure that we follow where the data was developed in the clinical trials that the companies brought us. It could be a promise of one dose being good enough.
With the vaccines, I mean, still, this is going to be a process that's at least a month in terms of the distribution and the vaccinations that would rise to the level combined with infections of herd immunity, it would seem. At least that's what some of the experts suggest. Is HHS... Is HHS still tracking the developments with therapeutic treatments? There was a study out, another study, actually, about this... anti-parasitic drug. Actually, it's a head lice drug called ivermectin. A study out of Liverpool University suggests that, and it builds on an earlier study of the same drug, that suggests that it has a real impact in terms of eliminating the viral RNA in the patients who were, you know, part of the study.
Yep. I mean, I think that there's literally hundreds of potential therapeutics out there. Everything from the monoclonal antibodies that we sponsored out of Warp Speed through any number of other potential things. And I think that's where, you know, a patient talks to their doctor. They look at those, you know, provisional results and decide what's best for them to do. You know, we don't regulate the practice of medicine here at the federal government at HHS. So for people to take a look at those, at that information, talk to their doctors, figure out whether that's something that they want to look at, is something that is completely valid for a patient and a doctor to do. You know, I can't give an opinion about any particular product myself, but that's where the kind of freedom that we have to look at these things and decide what's best. But you know, one of the things that we want to make sure we do is to make sure that people do know that there are lots of therapeutics out there that have been developed that are available to people. to get uptake on that. So that's important, especially as you well said, this is going to be a process, even at the quickest pace, this is going to be a process of getting 330 million people or however many people will choose to be vaccinated, getting them vaccinated. So even on our, you know, the best estimates that we had and have at the time, the 100 million that you mentioned, that the secretary mentioned by the end of February. And by the way, we are seeing some signs that the pace of vaccination is picking up. I think people have seen are adapting on the fly as they see who's willing to take the vaccine, where they're willing to take it, who's doing a better job than others at getting it out there, and what modalities are being done. So I'm happy to see that. I think that people are being sort of awake about the issues that have developed. Not everybody. Some people are really stuck in their plans, even when they don't work. Dangerous place to be is to double down on a plan that didn't work and try to just keep jamming at it. But, you know, that's a situation that in many cases some jurisdictions are going to be in, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah. At least for now.
Yes. We've seen a lot of politicians. Yeah, we've seen a lot of politicians doubling down on COVID-related policies that don't work across a range of topic areas. No question about that. Yep. Eric Hargan, Deputy Secretary of Health and Human Services. Eric, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Sure. Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Interesting reader comment over at James Freeman's Best of the Web column at the Wall Street Journal. Reader who believes that Joe Biden won the 2020 election wrote this to Freeman. The left needs to accept the fact that too many of the things they told us could not possibly be true turned out to be true. Right up to calling him a liar for saying there would be a vaccine. And now they expect normal people who don't follow politics 24/7 to simply believe them that everything is on the up and up, you know, just like the FISA investigation. Everyday people are expected to be able to understand that, even though they see a bag of votes discovered here and an irregularity there, that these are isolated incidents and don't define the entire system. And journalists look down on these people and their cognitive biases, and then the same journalists see a George Floyd video and are ready to dismantle police departments.
Or a Jacob Blake video.
That's a letter from someone who believes Joe Biden won the 2020 election, trying to explain and provide some consideration for those who are raising legitimate questions right up until the very end, and perhaps even suggesting things that would be inappropriate right up until the very end, including the president suggesting that Mike Pence can do things that Mike Pence cannot do constitutionally in this process. But there is a variety of opinion on that topic. Mm-hmm. And for more on it, we're pleased to be joined again by our friend Ken Blackwell. He is a former Ohio Secretary of State, former mayor of Cincinnati as well, and he is a board member of the Trump-Pence campaign. Ken, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Amy, Dan, good to be with you all.
Pleasure to have you. And what is it that you hope comes to pass today? What is the point of today from your perspective representing the campaign?
Well, you look, I woke up this morning to a quote from Churchill. I don't know what drove me to the quote, but I think it's most appropriate. Churchill said, "Success is not final, failure is not fatal. It is the courage to continue that counts." What I want to do is to make sure that your listeners and the broader audience in this country understand that while Democrats cry outrage over Republicans' challenges to the November 3rd, 2020 election, they seem to have forgotten their party's actions over the past two decades. in the years 2001, 2005, and 2017, Democrats challenged the electoral votes and slates following presidential elections in 2000, 2004, 2016. And so despite Democrats and anti-Trumpers alike chastising the president and Republicans who believe that irregularities and trans-constitutional actions took place in that election, they must remember that they, in fact, did the same thing in those years I just mentioned. And I happened to be at the eye of the storm in 2004 and 5 when Stephanie Tubbs Jones and other members challenged the slate of electors from Ohio on the floor at the joint meeting in 2005 on the base. And look, the spread in Ohio that year between Kerry and Bush, Bush won Ohio by 118,000 votes. So this notion that somehow this is anti-democratic, unconstitutional, is just a farce. And so my hope is that the senators are led by Senator Cruz and the House members led by Jim Jordan and others can actually put a little light on the irregularities and illegalities that took place and that affected the integrity of the election. The reason that's important is because in 2005, when the Democrats did it, it put in motion George Soros' SOS project, where they went out and elected liberal secretaries of state and attorney generals, and their long game strategy played out in 2020. We see that.
And right, and now down to the state's attorney and district attorney level, to your point. Mm-hmm. That is a good point to raise about the Soros program. But so the objections is one thing. What President Trump asserted about Vice President Pence's powers here is another. He said, I'm quoting, our vice president has several options under the United States Constitution. He can decertify the results or send them back to the states for change and certification. But that's not true, right?
Well, look, Dan, let me just say, that would have more of staying power if, in fact, official action was taken by state legislators. Legislatures.
Right.
You know, right now they have a letter from 140 plus state legislators from affected states, but they don't have official action. If the president, vice president, who actually is officiates the meeting, had that in front of him, he could officiate. And that would be challenged, perhaps by Democrats, but the proof would be on them to say that the vice president's role is just purely ceremonial, and that he can't make any judgments when he has official actions presented to him from legislatures. But he doesn't have that, and so you're right. He can't just make up things out of whole cloth. He has to have that. And then I say that he's on good footing to put the pressure on Democrats to challenge. Look, this is not purely ceremonial. If in fact, Biden and Harris are seated and she is officiating at a 50-50 split, her vote counts. It's not ceremonial. This is real stuff. And the framers of our Constitution, saw that while this might not happen every other year, in situations where there is a contest and contested results, this is a way to make sure that the representatives of the people, not some bureaucrats, make the final decision on certification.
So they want an electoral commission, but they're going to need 60 votes from the Senate in order to make that happen. Are the votes there?
I I think the votes, your question right now, the mm-hmm. votes are probably not there. If I look at those folks who count noses for Senator McConnell, the votes are not there. We know they're not there in the House. So the issue becomes, how do we frame this to bring as much sunlight to this process as possible? This is going to be extended because this is not just one member of the House and one member of the Senate. This is a substantial number of folks who will raise objections and make the case. And the case won't just be for Donald Trump. The case will be made for the integrity of our electoral system, and that is so important to the nature of our republic.
Do you believe that the apparent outcome of the Georgia Senate races will have any impact on what happens today?
I think at the end, this is in 2001, they had a 50-50 split. And there was a lot of rearranging of the chairs and a lot of negotiations for how they governed. The fact is that if it remains, or if it turns out that Republicans lost both seats and it's a 50-50 split, Joe Manchin probably becomes the most powerful senator in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly. It's going to take a lot of back and forth between the Schumer and McConnell to decide how they govern. But in the final analysis, if it gets to a vote and there's a 50-50 split, Harris would break the tie. And so the answer to your question is that the Democrats are in a stronger position today than they would have been if, in fact, we split those seats in Georgia or had won both of them.
He is Ken Blackwell, former Ohio Secretary of State and Mayor of Cincinnati, now also a member of the Trump-Pence campaign board representing the campaign. Ken, thanks for joining us. As always, appreciate it.
God bless you.
Thanks. You too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer
on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy and Senator Mitt Romney may want to use some of that Bain Capital money to fly private from now on.
Well, doesn't he have a private plane? I thought for sure he had.
This is how he was serenaded on a commercial flight to D.C.
You know what we think!
Traitor! Traitor! Traitor!
You get the gist of it. Apparently, they believe there was a snake on the plane.
Exactly. I see what you're saying. Flying Delta, is he?
Quickly, because I want an answer to this question.
Yes.
David in Lansing.
Hi. I was thinking about me. I promised my relatives and friends that if Trump loses, I would release a kraken of sarcasm. I'm going to make a T-shirt that says, I voted times 1.25. What do you think?
All right, quickly.
My next thing is, what two things do Jacob Blake officers, Father Flager, Trump, and Biden all have in common? They're all white males and are all about to be removed from power. But I'll be here all the week. Try the veal.
All right. Thanks for the call, David.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.